I'm Mike Waters with Options. Did you ever hear of the Delaney Clause? Perhaps not. But you should know it's that part of federal law that's intended to protect your food and medicine from the addition of cancer-causing chemicals, or carcinogens. In this program, a legislator, a biochemist, and a consumer advocate discuss the Delaney Clause and food additives. Moderator for the program is Irma Ondahl, a public radio station WAMU-FM in Washington. The guests are Gilbert Goldhammer, formerly with the Food and Drug Administration and now consultant to a congressional subcommittee, Dr. Jacqueline Verrett, researcher with the FDA for 15 years, and author of Eating May Be Hazardous to Your Health, and Ruth Desmond, president of a homemakers association in Northern Virginia. The discussion was arranged by Betty Ray Stevick, who also poses some questions. To begin, Irma Ondahl states her understanding of the Delaney Clause.
My idea of it is that it is a protection for the consumers of food in this country against having anything in the food that could possibly lead to cancer. Is that too simplistic a statement? Anybody have?
No, that's about it.
That's about it. I think that's what it's intended to do. I'm not sure it accomplishes that. Not because it isn't adequate in what it says, but in the actual enforcement of it, we have a lot of loopholes, unfortunately. For example, it says that the material has to cause cancer in a well-designed experiment in which experts in the field of cancer conclude that there is a cause-effect relationship between the ingestion by the oral route, incidentally, the way that we take it in food, by ingestion by the animal and the actual production of cancer. However, in evaluating these experiments, many loopholes seem to exist. One favorite one is I'm familiar with one experiment at Food and Drug in which there was a large incidence of cancer in animals which had been fed the additive. That it's pointless to mention which one it is. There were 20-some tumors in the animals that were on the diet. These tumors were randomly distributed in the body, randomly distributed among the groups that were fed the material. There was only one tumor in the control, that is, the animals that had been given nothing. Now, this seems to me an overwhelming indictment that this material has some potential to cause cancer. And yet, the experts agreed on this. There was really no relationship, no reason to consider it a carcinogen, because there was no target organ. Now, what they look for is a cancer inducer to affect a specific organ in the body. They feel that if, you know, it seems to be nonspecific with respect to sight, that there is less cause for worry. I'm not so sure that we can be that confident, because we have seen some carcinogens, which we now know cause cancer in humans, which do not affect just a specific site. So this is the type of loophole that is used, and that material is still on the market today, a widely used additive.
Now, what is the answer to this changing the Delaney Clause, reinterpreting, amending?
Can I give a little history of the Delaney Clause? The original Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act was passed in 1938. It had some very good provisions to protect the public against poisonous substances. There was no specific mention of cancer or cancer-producing substances. A food was deemed to be adulterated if it contained any added substance which might render it injurious, or even natural substance, which might render injurious to health. Now, that's the broad thing, and the FDA had a lot of latitude. But it had to prove, in the case of added poisons, that it wasn't necessary in the manufacture, and two, that it was poisonous or deleterious. Now, if you had that combination, then the FDA could rule it out, no matter how small, no matter how tiny was the trace. But in every instance, the obligation was upon Food and Drug to prove that it was a poisonous and deleterious substance. Now, with the increasing use of chemicals in food since 1938, it's really exploded. The chemicalization of our food supply and everything else about our lives has increased with explosive force since then. In 1958, it was recognized that it could get out of hand, whereas FDA had it very well under control up to that time. If the trend continued, it was clear that we were going to have problems. Now, Delaney chaired a committee that looked into the use of chemicals, and they looked into it for a period of about 5 years, and it culminated in the introduction of a bill known as the Food Additive Bill, and that was passed in 1958. Now, at the time, the differences between the House version and the Senate version were being ironed out in conference committee. The Delaney Clause was added, and this was added because of pressure brought to bear by no less of a person than the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare. The Delaney Clause, well, first, the pattern of the Food Additives Amendment, what does it do? It requires that the manufacturer of any substance that was to be added to a food, and there was a definition provided in the law for a food additive, it's something that is added to the food to affect its characteristics and becomes a component of that food. Now, the amendment provides for the secretary to approve food additives upon a showing of safety by the producer, the guy who wants to put it in interstate commerce. The Delaney Clause prohibits the secretary from approving the food additive if it has been shown to have caused cancer in man by ingestion, or in animals by ingestion, or has been shown to produce cancer in animals by a scientific method which is calculated to show whether or not the thing is capable of producing cancer in animals. Now, the force and effect of this bill and what Congress intended it to do can only be accomplished if the Food and Drug Administration enforces it. Now, questions can always arise. Has the substance caused cancer? In other words, is it a carcinogen? Are the lesions which are found in animal studies of the type that Dr. Verrett does, are these lesions really cancer? Now, at that point, there can be argument. One group of experts will say no, another group of experts yes. That's because there is a gray area where the expert can't be absolutely certain in his own mind whether it's cancer. Now, as long as that difference of opinion exists, FDA could go either way. They could take a strict view, or they could take a lenient view, favoring the product as against favoring protection to the public. And I think right now this is a question that concerns FDA in connection with the saccharin. Saccharin is very much open to question: is it a carcinogen or isn't it? And the experts can't make up their minds. Some say yes, some say no. In the meantime, it's out on the market. It'll be too bad if it turns out to be a carcinogen.
You said something about in 1958, Mr. Cronin, you talked about the explosion of chemical additives. Can you give us any relative figures? For instance, how many pounds do we eat? How many pounds per year?
Well, it's estimated that each person in this country, man, woman, and child, consumes about 5 pounds of these chemicals a year. Now, I don't know whether this is a lot or a little bit. It would be a lot for some of those highly poisonous substances because it's amazing what minute amounts of toxic substances can have an effect. Almost microscopic amounts in the case of botulinum toxin, botulism, it's almost a microscopic amount that can have disastrous effects in us. So in terms of botulinum toxin, 5 pounds could probably kill every person in the country. Mm-hmm. So it's a very, very large amount on the by and large, because there isn't a food that you eat that doesn't have a food additive.
May I say that when we advise our members in our newsletter that goes out throughout the country, we have members in practically every state, we are now taking the advice of Dr. Michael Jacobson of the Center for Science in the Public Interest, and also Dr. Jacqueline Verratt in her own book here, Eating May Be Hazardous to Your Health. And we have been advising our members for some years to eat only fresh foods, to eat them and cook them yourself at home, the way our grandmothers and our mothers did. And I'm a grandmother, so I started out cooking from scratch 36 years ago, and I still do. And that way you are subjected maybe to pesticide residues and some hormones and very other suspect chemicals in the meat and vegetables, but you don't have the additional preservatives and dyes and artificial flavorings you get in packaged foods. In my house, there are no packaged foods and haven't been for 20 years when I first learned that my husband was suffering from bladder cancer. I felt that at least I could protect his body and build up his natural defenses by eliminating all these suspect chemicals. So at least in our family, there are no 5 pounds of chemicals ingested yearly.
That's at least one way you can handle it at your own level, but you, as you say, you're not completely free of all this, but you do have at least a minimum amount rather than a maximum.
At least 5 pounds are eliminated.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's
Irma,
true.
Can I get back to the Delaney Clause
sure.
for just a second? You might ask, why did they single out cancer and say that if a substance produces cancer in animals, you can't use it as a food additive? Why didn't they say if it produces nerve damage, you can't use it in human beings? Well, in the first place, cancer is a dreadful disease. Even if there's a suspicion of cancer and you're not sure that it is cancer, you're subjected to some awful, terrible treatment. For instance, a nodule on the breast could result in surgery, and even though it may be perfectly benign. So the disease is a dreadful one. But more important than that, I think, is the fact that a no-effect level for a carcinogen has never been established. Now, that was the telling point that the Secretary of HEW made to the Congress in getting the Delaney Clause passed. You don't know how much it takes to trigger a cancer. It might be a molecule, although that's greatly disputed. But a molecule getting into the cell, one molecule getting into a cell, theoretically has the potentiality of changing the nature of that cell if it hits the right part of the RNA or DNA, rather. You could change the replication pattern so that it becomes a wildly growing cell. And if it survives the body immunity process, you've got cancer. And it might only be one molecule. Nobody can say no. But the point is, without knowing at which point a quantity of carcinogen is safe, it's only common sense and prudency to say none of it is to be found in our food. Because there's no way of combating cancer other than to prevent exposure.
Now, this you would consider to be, I suppose, the scientific basis for the Delaney Clause.
Right.
This is it.
Often the question is asked, why did they single out cancer? That's the explanation.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we talk about discovering this, whether or not it's carcinogenic, we obviously can't practice on people.
That's right.
And I think at this point, if we have got clearly in mind now what the Delaney Clause is all about, then let's get to how we determine these things. This is a real question in the public mind, I think. Dr. Verratt, in her book, takes time to explain this in some depth so that you really do feel, for the first time, that I really understood the transfer of the studies on the animals to the application to the human condition. And perhaps, Dr. Verratt, you would take the time at this moment to explain to us how we determine whether or not, under the Delaney Clause, a substance is carcinogenic. Would that be the next step, you think?
That's
Would
right.
Everybody agree?
Yeah.
Okay, let's do it.
Well, animal experiments, of course, are the basis for the determination. And the usual experiment involves several groups of animals fed different doses of the chemicals. These doses are usually selected at logarithmic intervals. Now, that may not be understandable to some of our listening audience, and I won't try to explain that, but it's in increasing doses, and the higher doses are many, many times the expected exposure levels, so that we are covering quite a wide range of concentrations. Included in the experiment will be a group of animals which have not received the chemical at all. These are the controls, and of course there is a normal incidence in every population of some cancer and other adverse effects. So you have to know what your background is, and this control group of animals is to establish that. There might be still another group if the chemical in question has to be administered in a vehicle. Let's say it's an insoluble solid, and it's given to them other than in being mixed in with the food. It might be given, say, in corn oil or some other type of liquid to give it, find a way to get it down into their stomachs. If that is the case, then there would be an additional group of animals that receive just that vehicle, the corn oil, for example, to give you the background for whatever that might induce. Now, there are always questions raised, and frequently Food and Drug is guilty of using this statement, and the industry uses it very widely. The doses are, you know, thousands of times higher than the humans might get.
I'm sorry to say, I think I've said that myself.
Yes. And they use this in an attempt to say that, therefore, the results that were obtained have no relevance to the human situation. There are reasons, however, for using high doses. The primary reason being that animals are generally much less sensitive than the human. Now, we know this for a fact because we know this from studies with drugs where we have administered them to animals and we have also administered them to people. And we know that in order to produce a given effect, whatever that might be, lowering blood pressure or whatever, that in animals that are commonly used in the laboratory, such as the mouse, the rat, the dog, the cat, the rabbit, the hamster, they may be anywhere from 3 to 10 or even higher than that, times less sensitive than the humans, meaning that it takes 10 times as much to induce a given effect in the animal. The second reason for using these excessive doses at the upper end of the testing is that in these animal experiments, the numbers of animals involved are woefully small. I know of some chemicals which are on the market that have been tested in 5 rats or 5 mice, and that type of test actually was just for the acute toxicity, whether it would kill or not. But in order to determine cancer, what is generally done, the chemical in question is fed over the animal's lifetime. Cancer has the unique property of taking a very long time to appear after the initial insult. It has a very long induction period. It may be 10, 15, 20, 30, even 40 years has been demonstrated. Workers who were exposed, for example, to naphthalamine-type compounds in factories developed bladder cancer some 30 to 40 years after they started working. So the induction period is long. So we feed it for the full lifetime of the animal, which for the rodent, like the rat and the mouse, is about 2 years to maybe 2.5 years in some strains. At the end of that experiment, and of course during the experiment, if animals die, they are examined by a pathologist for conditions of the tissues and so forth, and for the appearance of tumors. And the second thing that has to be determined is, if a tumor is induced in the animal, is it a malignant tumor? Is it going to spread to adjoining organs and then perhaps throughout the body? As a result of the study, of course, it takes statistics to determine whether the finding of 1, 2, or 3 tumors is meaningful. And this is the big problem with the animal experiments. As I mentioned, a typical experiment might have 20 animals at each dose level. If you find one tumor out of those 20 animals, that means it's occurring in 5% of that particular population. The problem arises, suppose it is a carcinogen that only induces tumors in 1%. The chances are you're not going to see it. You would have to have at least 100 animals at that dose level in order to detect a cancer occurring in 1% of the population. So these experiments, in other words, may not be detecting the weaker carcinogens, of which we probably have plenty. And this is the difficulty, too, with the interpretation of some of these experiments. It is said, since we didn't see any, or we only had one occurring at two dose levels and not the other two, you know, they rule it out as being a serious thing, not realizing, of course, that the population is so small that you may simply have missed it. As a result, if, let's say, it is a carcinogen, of course, that would rule it out. But let's say it has another effect. I don't know what, pick anything, causes nerve damage or what have you. It might be possible then to still use it, but what is done is a 100-fold safety margin is established. And that is to account for the difference in sensitivity of the animal, which I mentioned earlier was could be as much as 10 times less sensitive than the human. And the other factor of 10 is to account for the small numbers of animals involved. So we build in a 100-fold safety factor, and what is said then is that the food additive can be used at 1/100th of the dose that induced an effect in the animal experiment. But to stay with the cancer, of course, if there is a finding of cancer in the experiment and it is concluded that it was a result of the ingestion of the chemical, generally what they look for is a dose relationship. I myself am not convinced that you have to have a dose relationship to say that it caused cancer. But what they mean by that is, and this is the sort of thing you would expect if everything followed rigid laws, that at the lower dose level you'd have one tumor, twice that dose you'd have twice as many, and four times that you'd have four times as many, et cetera, et cetera. But it always doesn't always work out that way. If you had a big enough sample, if you had 1,000 animals at each dose level, you might see that sort of thing. But if it's a low incidence of cancer and you're only dealing with 20 animals, then obviously you're not going to see it.
And I might add to that, if I may, that any given cancer, like cancer of the breast, even though it hits a lot of people, the incidence is much less than 1 out of 100. It's more on the order of 50, 60 per 10,000. What does that make it? 4 in 1,000, 5 in 1,000, mm-hmm. would be closer to it than 1 in 100. So any cancer, any given cancer taken by itself is a relatively rare disease. And to take 100 animals and find negative results may not be meaningful at all. And Dr. Verrett, isn't another reason for the large doses that you use to compensate for the fact that you can't work with large numbers of animals, but you're rather limited?
Yes.
You may work with 25 at this dose, 25 at this dose, 25 at another dose.
Yes.
And therefore you give a large dose to see whether it has any carcinogenic potential at
yes,
all.
Yes, that was the second reason
yes.
I gave.
Yeah.
Now, there are some experiments being done now. Food and Drug has a research arm in Arkansas, the National Center for Toxicological Research, in which they are attempting to see whether or not using these large numbers of animals will allow you to predict a no-effect level for carcinogens. I find that to be an exercise in futility, and some other experts in cancer do too. But the objective there is to use 1,000 animals at a dose level or more.
Right.
They're called mega mouse experiments. What they are studying right now are known carcinogens. They're not looking at food additives. They're looking at known carcinogens. I think the difficulty with this type of experiment, as noble as it might seem on the surface, is that when you do get a result, it's going to apply only to that chemical anyway. You're not going to be able to extrapolate it to another chemical and say that it would have the same potential mm-hmm. at that dose level. So it's taking an enormous amount of money to study one chemical. when we might better spend that screening in a few animals. I'm not saying we should stay with 20. I think we ought to aim for more than 20 animals at a dose level, but somewhere in between, let's say 100 animals at a dose level, and screen a lot more of these chemicals, because we have hundreds of food additives that have never been screened for cancer at all.
Let me interrupt here just a moment. You've heard the voice of Dr. Jacqueline Verrett, who is the author of Eating May Be Hazardous to Your Health and a biochemist and researcher for the Food and Drug Administration. Ruth Desmond is with us. She's the president of the Federation of Homemakers Incorporated, and Gilbert S. Goldhammer, consultant to the Fountain House Committee, a subcommittee on intergovernmental affairs. And we are talking about the Delaney Clause. We have tried to lay out some of the problems that are inherent in this whole problem of the Delaney Clause, which I should add at this point is being threatened. We start out with the discussion of the Delaney Clause saying this is the protection built into the law. Now we have to talk about some of the threats that are happening. Dr. Verrett has just explained very carefully how they arrive at certain conclusions that a carcinogenic substance is present. And as she has described, it's a sort of a chancy kind of thing. Now then, if you add to the body of this information and you say that now all of a sudden people are talking about what is an acceptable level, this gets us back to what we were saying, what would happen if we just simply threw out anything that was questionable. Suppose now we have people working who say, well, if one out of 20 rats showed a tumor, then that means that so long as the carcinogenic element is not any greater than X percent, it's okay. What happens? Is this a threat to us?
Well, I think it is if you just translate that into terms of humans. If it causes cancer in 1% of the human population, that's 2 million people. If it's in only a tenth of a percent, that's 200,000 people. I think that's far too many.
I agree.
One is too many.
But now, there are people who are saying that there are acceptable dose levels, aren't there?
Well, there seem to be some politicians who seem to be very sympathetic to the industry who put these chemicals in our foods for profit that seem to think we should find this acceptable level. Jamie Whitten, who is chairman of the House Subcommittee on Appropriations for Agriculture, Environmental Protection Agency, the Federal Trade Association, and the Food and Drug Administration, is one who is very liberal in this type of view. He has practically commanded Food and Drug to find a safe level. And I think this is something that our public doesn't realize, the pressures on the agency. Chairman Whitten, if I may be allowed to go on, took $200,000 of our tax money and gave it to Food and Drug to try to find a way to eliminate this Delaney anti-cancer clause protection we share. And I happened to be at the meeting when Food and Drug presented their decision, and you could see they were practically quaking, that they had to tell him that the best scientific information, the best cancer researchers in this country, especially those at the National Cancer Institute, said there is still no safe amount of a carcinogen to be put in our food. And nevertheless, Chairman Whitten and several members of his subcommittee that come from the West, where the livestock is raised, said to them, you go back and you find steps whereby we will progress to the point where we will find the safe level. And I must say, to his credit, that Dr. Schmidt appeared absolutely dazed and benumbed at such a request, when he had made it very emphatic that their hands, the agency's hands, were tied. Now he is under this threat because his money comes from the generosity of this subcommittee on appropriations to try to go ahead with this extraordinary command from Chairman Whitten. This is something that our own group, having been present is able to disseminate. This had never gotten into the newspapers because there was no press present at this particular confrontation.
Well, when you talk about an animal experiment and you determine a certain level of the possibility of cancer, then you also have this question where people are sent back to the drawing board to try to find a safe level and so on and so forth. Now, to me, you are talking about one lifetime of one rat or 20 rats or whatever.
Right.
Now, we are not going to be fed just that one chemical.
No.
What about the effect of what... it's a new word to me. Synergistic?
Synergism. Or
all right. Now, what happens there if we have to live?
This is a very important point.
Yeah, and so that if you do find a safe level for one chemical, what good does that do us?
Not very much, really, because we do know from experiments, animal experiments, that many chemicals which have no adverse effects when used individually do have adverse effects when combined. And this is called, as you were saying, synergism or potentiation, meaning in some way they react or reinforce each other to give a more drastic effect than either can have alone. And, of course, this is the problem with food additives. This is why I wrote the book. We're not exposed to one chemical or 10 or 30 or 100. We're exposed to thousands. And interestingly enough, when Food and Drug was formed many years ago in the early 1900s, there were only about 30 or 40 food additives. And the admitted mission of the agency was to get rid of them.
And they did
to some extent. Dr. Wiley was very adamant about that. Now their mission seems to be to approve them and add to the numbers that are being used when we know even less about them and they're much less thoroughly studied. And we're concerned here in the case of this discussion on the Delaney Amendment primarily with direct food additives. There is one part of this whole picture that rarely gets mentioned, and that is our exposure to indirect additives. Now, we've mentioned some, such as the pesticide residues, which might be on vegetables, hormones, antibiotics, and a host of other chemicals in poultry and cattle and so forth as a result of the feeding of the animals on diets containing these chemicals. There are still others. There are materials that migrate into food from packaging materials. There are hundreds of chemicals involved in packaging alone. That, I think, is rarely realized by the average consumer. You buy a can of a soft drink or a can of anything, and it has a wax liner or a plastic liner to keep the food, whether it's juice or soft drink or whatever, from reacting with the metallic, you know, can and taking on that taste. And this liner may have 5 or 10 chemicals in it, which can be leached out, eluted by the liquid in the can, so that you're getting minute amounts of these chemicals. Unfortunately, they're tested even less than the direct food additives. Many of them have never been fed to animals. And we don't know whether they cause cancer or not. As Mr. Goldhammer has said, we don't know whether one molecule is enough to cause it or not. But the philosophy behind this lack of testing is that you're getting them in minute amounts. I don't think that's adequate protection. So there's this whole area of chemicals that we're being assaulted with. We have environmental pollutants. We have mercury. We have things like aflatoxin, which is a natural contaminant of food, and which Food and Drug does make a very large effort, of course, to keep out of the human food supply. It's produced by a mold, which gets on food that is improperly stored, grains in particular, and nuts. And it is a very potent carcinogen. So here is something which gets into the food by natural means. In addition to that, of course, there is some evidence that some foods which we accept to be safe and natural parts of our diet may have ingredients which are not entirely safe. Cabbage has an ingredient in it which affects the thyroid. Lima beans has something which causes adverse effects, and so on and so on. So even our natural foods may not be altogether safe. And we are compounding that, however. This is even more reason, I think, to be conservative with food additives, because we have a natural burden of toxicants which we cannot avoid. And it seems folly to be increasing that burden by the addition of a lot of synthetic chemicals, which are not tested at all or inadequately tested.
I might say that the law takes cognizance of that. Congress, in giving guidelines, and this is part of the law, the Food Additives Amendment, giving guidelines to the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, that has who has the responsibility to enforce the law, stated that in considering safety, you will take into account not only the use of the additive in the particular food for which it is proposed, but you will also consider whether or not this occurs naturally, whether it may have application to other foods, whether there are compounds similar to it already in the food supply which have certain effects to which this would be additive. Congress intended, when it passed the Food Additives Law, that the determination of safety would be based solely upon the evidence, and that that safety alone evidence would determine. Economic matters were not to be considered. Whether the product will accomplish a purpose, and is it safe for that purpose, are the only two considerations. I remember when I was with the Food and Drug Administration, and of course you've got to remember that when I came into the Food and Drug Administration, we didn't even have the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. We were operating under that first law passed in 1906 known as the Food and Drugs Act, so-called Pure Food Act. So I witnessed the evolution of the legislation to what it is today. I can say that by 1958, I was, shall I say, in the top drawer in FDA, and I was in with the highest councils, and I remember the discussions, whether or not the benefits to risk balancing applied, which was a principle that held for drugs, whether it applied to food additives. And universally, it was agreed, no, Congress never intended that there be a balancing of the risks and the benefits. You just considered the risks and evaluated on that basis, but you did take into account whether or not the intended effect would be accomplished. In other words, if this were a preservative, whether it did preserve, whether it was a cosmetic ingredient like a flavor or an odor or a color, did it accomplish its purpose? And then was it safe? How much money was involved? How much of an industry was involved? Wasn't the concern of the Food and Drug Administration. Today, that concept is perverted. And it all happened within the last 5 years. Because in 1969, it was still the declared policy of the Food and Drug Administration not to use the benefits versus risk evaluation in determining whether or not a food additive shall be approved.
The threat that presently exists, how do you evaluate that? Is it a serious threat? Are they really trying to eliminate this for this reason?
The Delaney Clause?
Yes.
I go around saying I don't think they stand a chance. As long as the cancer incidence and the cancer mortality rates continue to climb inexorably year after year in excess of what one would expect by reason of the aging population, and as long as we don't know why, and as long as it makes sense to say in this period of lack of information that the only defense you have is to not expose yourself. We know that chemicals produce cancer. Some do. We know that. There's no question about that. Don't expose yourself is the only defense you have. Now, it would be insanity, in my opinion, in view of these facts that I've just indicated, namely the rising incidence, the rising mortality rate, and the lack of information, to create a situation where there would be added exposure to carcinogens. It's bad enough that you've got it in drugs. The Food and Drug Administration allows drug after drug on the market, which are proven carcinogens. It's all done on the benefits to risk ratio. But you're dealing with sick people. You have to help them. They may get worse and die, so you're willing to take chances. But with food additives, you're dealing with the well as well as the sick. And the sick shouldn't be exposed to this because they may be more susceptible. Mm-hmm. Not everybody has equal susceptibility. You know, there are people who have allergies. Well, you could have an allergy to a carcinogen and come down with cancer. This is not imagination. This is fact. Mm-hmm. So it's sheer folly to create a situation where you will permit increased exposure to carcinogens. Bad enough as it is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Congress deliberately went out of its way to take from the agency any discretion, any administrative discretion as to whether they shall allow it or not allow it. If it's shown to have produced cancer in animals by ingestion, the administrator of the law has no discretion whatever. He may not approve it. That's a prohibition in the law. And now what they want to do, they say this is unscientific, those who propose it's, they should be given administrative discretion. If you give them administrative discretion, you'll be increasing the risk.
Mm-hmm.
Until we know more about it. There may come a time when the Delaney Clause properly is taken out of the law, but we're far, far from it. No different from what it was in 1959 when Congress hurriedly put it in at mm-hmm. the urging of the Secretary.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think, Mr. Goldhammer, then a lot of this help in keeping the Delaney Clause will have to come from constituents of the Congress, because the Congress is bombarded constantly, daily, by those who want to, for profits, have our food treated with mild carcinogens if it will be profitable. And I think that it's very necessary then for the public to be made aware in books such as Dr. Verrett has written of the risks they are taking, and then to realize, as her book also tells, to get in touch with your congressman, to get in touch with groups who are in touch with congressmen, because otherwise these men find it very difficult to hold out. These lobbyists have the finest lawyers. They have their own scientists that come there, and they can be so convincing, so very convincing, that it will take the public, an aroused and an enlightened public, I think, to retain this Delaney Clause until there is a time when perhaps it may not be needed.
I would just want to say there is one example of how pressure can be brought to bear on Congress. We now have a law which allows the producers of oranges in Florida to dye them with a dye called citrus red 2, which has been shown to cause cancer in animal experiments. And you don't eat the peel normally, but some people do. Certainly they make marmalade, children suck on oranges. So we do have an exposure to this carcinogen. And interestingly enough, the Florida growers bombarded Congress because they were at a disadvantage with the California market, which has nice, brightly orange oranges, and Congress allowed the Florida manufacturers to dye there so that they could be competitive. So here we have Congress, by enacting a law, actually putting a carcinogen into the food supply. And as Mrs. Desmond mentioned, of course, there are tremendous pressures from industry. Consumer lobbies simply don't have that type of clout behind them. And it's the same at Food and Drug. There is no input from the consumer at Food and Drug. It is all from industry. They are padding the halls all day long and sitting there in meetings and in phone calls and what have you. And they can come in with scientific information. There have been many regulations proposed in the Federal Register. And when the opportunity is given for comment, consumers comment because they have the gut feeling that this is not safe or it's not what we want. But they don't come up with a scientific experiment, and the industry does. And no matter how bad that experiment might be or what it might show, Food and Drug will listen to that and not to what the consumer said.
This is a strong point, and we get there, I think, into the whole question of the social judgment and the scientific judgment.
Yes.
And who's in charge here. Perhaps somebody would like to develop this a little further, and would you say the Congress makes the social judgment by passing the law, then it's up to what, NIH or HEW or FDA or any one of these other areas around the country to do the scientific work?
Yes, that's essentially true. The point that Mr. Goldhammer made was that they want to give the commissioner, or if you wish, the agency, the benefit of making the decision. And actually, the decision is made by the scientist who interprets the experiment. This is the key point.
Mm-hmm.
The decision that it is or is not a carcinogen should be made by qualified scientists who can judge the value of an experiment.
Now, where would they be in this structure?
Well, a lot of the information that we get now, a lot of the data now, are generated by the industry itself, you see.
That's the point.
Food and Drug is not doing the testing in most cases.
Yes.
They do brush fire experiments. You know, when something comes up on cyclamate or saccharin, then they scurry around and set up a big experiment.
Or red number two.
Or red number two, and then they test it for the next 30 years. Meanwhile, it stays on the market. But ordinarily, the burden of proof rests with the proponent of use, so that when a food additive is proposed, the one who proposes to use it has to come in with the data. So we have the added problem that most of the data are generated by the industry wanting to use something. And their conclusions are accepted. Many times, these particular data are not actually evaluated by people, let's say, at the National Cancer Institute, where it ought to be evaluated. Because Food and Drug does not really have a carcinogenic expert there at the moment. They don't have anybody, in my opinion, that is of a quality that is capable of actually making a judgment of that type. They have pathologists, yes, but I mean people of the same caliber as we have at the National Cancer Institute. So many times, of course, they do refer things to them and ask for their opinion, but that is not a routine. I mean, that is not automatic.
But doesn't it happen a lot that when you do have commissions or you have people sitting on committees of this kind that you end up with people who have been either with FDA or with industry, depending, you know,
yes.
And you get an awful lot of mixed up there of where are your loyalties?
Well, this is a point I make in the book, which, of course, has initiated an intense dislike for me. A lot of the matters are referred to the National Academy of Sciences. And the National Research Council, which is a working arm of the Academy, then evaluates the data, or reviews it, if you wish. And unfortunately, the great majority of the men on these committees turn out to be working for the very industry that manufactures the additive that is in question.
If you go
and
back.
I don't really think they're, and I know based on the type of conclusions they write, that they are not objective.
But you know, this goes back to what Mr. Goldhammer was saying earlier, that the whole thing is just... Well, it's not very well organized. That's all I can say, is that we have no real a spot where the buck stops. Is that a good way to put it?
Well, yeah. Let me say this. Yeah. FDA is not critical. That's the trouble. They're willing to swallow hook, line, and sinker everything that's given to them. Now, the experience that FDA has had in the past in connection with drug review work should convince FDA that they have to take with a grain of salt everything that's said. And salt's an additive. We're dealing with additives.
That's right.
But the point is that the Food and Drug Administration has uncovered concealment in the case of drug work, concealment of adverse data. For instance, in MER-29, which was a drug put out on the market. The drug was found to be dangerous in a study, and the Food and Drug Administration never learned about that because it was doctored. There was a time when, in connection with new drug work, the Food and Drug Administration maintained some degree of surveillance over the data that was submitted. They looked at it, examined it, but if there was anything that didn't look just right, investigations would be made. And these investigations have revealed this sort of thing. a large firm, and I'm not talking about firms here, I'm talking about large ones. I'm not going to name them, but if you insist upon it, I'll name them, because these are a matter of court record. In one case, a firm was prosecuted because in submitting a new drug application, that is the application for approval of a new drug or some change in the labeling of that drug, they failed to inform the Food and Drug Administration that they had records of X number of deaths caused by this drug. This happened to have been a tranquilizer, and I think there were 11, and subsequently it developed that there were a lot more than 11. They were prosecuted and fined. I told you about another firm, one of the top firms in the country, that withheld adverse data from the Food and Drug in the monkey study. They were fined $80,000 for that. In another study, in another case, which went to prosecution, a researcher simply synthesized out of the air data of a clinical study. There were no patients, but he synthesized patients, age, symptoms, used the drug theoretically only in the mind of this doctor, and submitted results, which were submitted to the Food and Drug Administration as proof of the effectiveness and safety of the drug. He was prosecuted. So there is ample reason to be very careful. I mean, if you really want to do your job to protect the public and view these submissions very critically, and make investigations to determine whether or not there's some hanky-panky going on. FDA does not do it at all, as far as I know, with food additives. They accept everything blindly. Am I right on that, Dr. Vann?
I agree. That's quite
true.
Oh,
dear.
BHA and BHT, of course, antioxidants. They are used, one wide use is in, of course, cooking oils, but they would be in mayonnaise or any food that contains fat, and the purpose is to prevent rancidity. BHA and BHT have both been implicated in adverse effects in animal experiments. I don't believe there have been any well-done experiments that demonstrate cancer, but they have caused adverse effects, I believe, involving the liver and thyroid and things like that. As a result, their use has been severely curtailed, I believe, in Britain and in Australia, where most of this research was done. However, we're still using them quite widely in this country. The reason the manufacturer uses these is to give it a shelf life such that if somebody doesn't sell it for a year, he can still keep it on his shelf without fear of having it recalled or having to recall it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the list that is in the book, it was put there primarily to show you that it isn't all that necessary, because some foods can be prepared without it.
Yeah,
and therefore all should be able to be prepared. Some manufacturers in the same type of oil, for example, use it while others don't.
Yes.
And these do not spoil noticeably within what is considered a normal shelf life, the time it takes the cooking oil to get from the factory to the supermarket to the home, where it usually rapidly disappears.
Yeah.
I don't think very many people have had trouble with it going rancid on them,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it stays there for a year and a half.
Oh, no.
And, of course, today we have been conditioned to accept these squishy, light loaves of bread as fresh bread. And as soon as it begins to get a little bit dry or hard, it's stale bread. They don't really resemble what bread ought to be. But these conditioners are put there to keep it in this moist state. And, you know, to give it the consistency that, you know, the ads now say, I'm the squeezable loaf, et cetera, et cetera. And we've come to think that bread should be squeezably soft, you know, instead of have some body to it. As far as MSG is concerned, don't ask me why they still use it. If I knew, I would have written a different book. They say it enhances flavor. I don't think it does. I don't use it personally, but I have had food where people have dumped it in, and I can't see any difference. I think that if you know how to cook, and I consider that I do, and you know how to use seasoning judiciously, then you don't need it.
The Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act requires a listing of all ingredients in all foods except those for which standards of identity have been promulgated. Standards of identity have been promulgated for cottage cheese, and that relieves the firm of listing the ingredients. Congress, in its wisdom, permitted this on the theory that if anybody wants to know what the ingredients in cottage cheese are, that a reference to the standard would give that information. But of course, try to find the standard and try to understand it, yeah, couched as it is in legal terminology. There are some steps being taken by some congressmen, Congressman Rosenthal being the leader, to amend the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act to correct this situation and to require a listing of all ingredients on all products, standardized or not.
I should say offhand that colors are one area where we know very little about their safety. In this country, there are, I believe, 30-some colors which are listed for use, of which several are derived from coal tar materials, aniline specifically, which has been implicated in human cancer. The food and drug laws on colors are such that they have now demanded that proof of safety be given by the proponents of use. But this has not been forthcoming with any great speed. And year after year, they continue to renew provisionally colors for use, which means that we still don't know whether they're safe or not, but they may continue to use them with not much restriction on how much is there and the variety of things in which they might appear. All medicine is highly colored. Why, I don't know. Most of us close our eyes and nose when we take it anyway. And, of course, you're getting the same things in food. As with other additives, they're not listed on the label. It may say artificially colored, but you don't know which ones are there. And a food may contain several colors to give it the proper hue. Food manufacturers are rather paranoid about getting the right shade and the right hue. When Red 2, which is a very common and widely used red dye, came under question a couple of years ago, they switched off to one which has been permanently listed, the only one, I think, Red 40. And unfortunately, that didn't last very long. Nothing has been done about Red 2 yet. It's still permitted at the same levels. And they've generally switched away from Red 40 because Red 40 does not give them the proper shades and hues that Red 2 will accomplish. So I just wish that we could do something about that, because I think this is an unnecessary exposure to materials which may be dangerous and may be carcinogens. Certainly in the area of food, and this is what I've written about in the book, I think it is a very frivolous use of food additives. It is purely there for deceptive purposes.
I think in the little while we have left, let's just review. The Delaney Clause was put in there into the legislation to protect the individual and the food he eats from carcinogens. And it has been determined that there is no way to say which is the safe amount of a carcinogen. Nobody knows. However, it has become, evidently, for some segments of the industry, it has become sort of a thorn in their flesh. They'd like to have it removed so that they don't have to provide this proof that there is nothing carcinogenic in the element.
You've been listening to a discussion of the Delaney Clause with Gilbert Goldhammer, consultant to a congressional committee, Dr. Jacqueline Verrett, FDA researcher and author, and Ruth Desmond, president of a homemakers association. Irma Ondo is the program moderator. Additional questions were posed by Betty Ray Stevick. The program was prepared for broadcast by David Eccleston. It was made possible with funds provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. For Options, I'm Mike Waters. This is NPR, National Public Radio.